So I've got 4:45. There's a lot of stuff I want to get through today, so we're going to get started. So good afternoon. Welcome to the SharePoint Admins, the Exchange Admins SharePoint Survival Kit. My name is Chris McNulty. I'm Chief Technology Officer for High Software up in New England. And I'll do a little bit more of an intro in a second, but I just want to convey how happy I am to see so many folks still here. You know, ever since I was a child, I remember watching the Olympic Winter Games, in Innsbruck and places like that. And when I was a kid, it was always Jim McKay. And he would be sitting there in the last day of the Olympics saying, and all the athletes are gathering for the closing party. It's been a wonderful Olympics. And then, meanwhile, the men's 30K cross-country team is still out there slogging it out while everyone else is still doing this. So the exhibit hall is closed. This is the last round of sessions, and you folks are the troopers for being here. I greatly appreciate that. My name is Chris McNulty. I am not an Exchange MVP. I am a SharePoint MVP. So I'm a stranger in a strange land this week. But it's been really nice to be here, and it's been very, I'm really excited to see how this conference runs, and it's been a lot of fun for me this week. I've been working in the SharePoint space for almost 14 years. My background is principally with large systems consulting and with ISVs. I live just outside of Boston, Massachusetts, and I'm going to thank my sponsors here in just a moment. My company, High Software, we focus on security, governance, and compliance tools for SharePoint and other Microsoft platforms. Visit us at highsoftware.com. They make it possible for me to indulge in my passion for traveling all over the world to talk about SharePoint and Office 365 and related technologies to audiences. And of course, the sponsors who really make it possible for me to do this is my wife, Haley, who's watching the kids this afternoon back home in Boston. How many of you have never been to Boston? Never been to Boston. Great. That's my house. I'm kidding, obviously. But that's Rachel, who's 7, Nate's 10, and my oldest, who took this picture, is Devin. She's a sophomore at NYU. But I am from Boston. We are very proud. We're looking forward to another good baseball year. It's about time for me to retire this photo, but this was taken at the World Series last year, Game 2. Sox lost, but it all worked out fine in the end. So what we're going to walk through today, we're going to start with an introduction to the SharePoint architecture. There's a lot to cover. We're going to move very quickly, and I'll be sticking around for questions at the end. Move on to the meat of this is looking at how do you manage and operate SharePoint, troubleshooting the most likely service requests that you're going to have. From there, we'll take a detour a bit into PowerShell. PowerShell, just with an Exchange, is essential to making the most important admin changes to your SharePoint environment, and I'll give you a primer on that. Some tips and techniques for optimizing the performance of SharePoint, principally on-premises, but some things that you can do also to make your life a little bit easier in Office 365. And we'll conclude by looking at best and worst practices that I've seen in my years consulting and working in software. So basically the rules are we're going to be looking at the core of this. We're not going to be doing deep dives into development or setup. I have to always be nice to the demo gods because my demos live in the cloud. I'm also going to say, not as a plea for sympathy in your evaluations, but I have the flu. I came down with the flu last night. So if I got to stay away from that. I thought I was hearing things. If I just keel over on the stage, someone just, call a medic or something. But I've had enough Tylenol and Diet Coke to get me through for at least the next 75 minutes, and then I can crash. But very much, I am SPC. I was at a Microsoft SharePoint conference presenting on a number of topics just about a month ago out in Las Vegas. So I just want to make that very clear. My experience with Exchange actually predates my experience with SharePoint. I haven't done a ton in SharePoint and Exchange, obviously, for the last 4 or 5 years. But I remember all the discussions Microsoft was having about 10 years ago about replacing the Jet Engine with SQL and then with public folders. We're going away 10 years ago. So did they come back? Because everyone seems to be talking about them. Public folders must have come back. No. Obviously, they've been talking about it forever. They'll be talking about it for another 10 years. Curious, by show of hands, how many of you would identify as an IT pro in your role? Developers? Usually not too many. Great. I'm hoping I have a lot of material in this deck, and I can be somewhat fluid if there's more or less that you want to hear. One thing I do want to jump over to is just for those of you who are playing with Yammer, for the second screen experience. Let's pause this down. Let's get over here. This should pick up. So I posted a poll on Yammer just to get a sense of where people are coming from, and not really a statistically significant sample with 5 respondents, but 3 people are using 365, 1 in 2010, and 1 in an older version. So let me ask the room, how many of you are running SharePoint on premises right now? Great. Oh, 365 SharePoint? Couple. That's usually the mix that I see. It's going up. It used to be no hands and a few, and eventually it's going to be a flood, but we're not there yet, as we know. Switch to this. So the problem that I want to solve is this one. Someone comes into your cube someday and says, congratulations, you're inheriting the SharePoint farm. With such a great honor, of course, there's usually not a big bump in pay or any bump in pay whatsoever. You still have your principal responsibilities that you've been keeping for Exchange, Active Directory, and everything else. So my goal is to show you how the functionality in SharePoint 2013 can be really effective at maximizing your time. Time is the one thing that you can't make more of. I believe that SharePoint is a very exciting technology. I'm very proud to work with it. And it is unparalleled in its ability to reach out and to enable a number of businesses and business processes around the world. And whether it's reaching out to allow nonprofit NGOs to serve public health care needs in sub-Saharan Africa, or just showing an admin how she can get home to her family 5 minutes earlier, I think it's really important, and it's one of the reasons why I'm so proud to be working with this. So let's plunge right in. Let's take a look at the SharePoint architecture. In case you don't know, the SharePoint servers generally fall into 3 classes. We have the web front-end servers, which for most of our end users that we support, they regard those as the SharePoint server. They provide the HTTP endpoints that people connect to through their browser. They can sometimes play query roles in smaller organizations, but the web front-end is a very important role in SharePoint. They can be easily scaled. They can be easily virtualized. And with any IIS server, RAM is usually the biggest performance boost or bottleneck in these guys. Second, application servers. In versions of SharePoint going back to 2007, the app server was essentially a monolithic role that provided user profiles and search indexing. That's been broken up over the last few years. And so there are a plethora of application roles for search crawl, search index, manage metadata, and any of the other service applications that sit under the hood for SharePoint 2013. Microsoft's made architectural changes so that these too can be scaled and failed over using the SharePoint fabric. It is somewhat debatable based on your actual mileage, but usually CPU is the biggest constraint on these because the search processing is the single biggest load that these servers will take. And search is very hungry. Search will grab every thread, and it'll open up 8 documents, each with 4 threads to do all of the crawling and the indexing on it. So these guys in anything but the smallest environments are usually often are being reserved. And lastly, the database server. So the database server is running SQL. All of SharePoint's content, and we'll talk a little bit about the variants on this later, but for most purposes, all SharePoint information lives inside a database, a content database or something else. It is a pure SQL implementation. There are no SharePoint binaries that get installed directly on the SQL server. So SQL should be kept fairly clean. And as with all SQL environments, disk input-output operations are the most important thing to optimize for the best performance. 80% of all end-user perceived problems with SharePoint go back to SQL Server. And of course, we have the no-server option, Office 365. In the SharePoint world, there's a lot of focus on what you can't do in Office 365 because you don't have the ability to run full trust code. How many of you are supporting custom applications in SharePoint anywhere in your environment? Anyone? A little bit. Okay. If you don't have them, 365 is a very easy transition for you. But it's the people, there's a lot of focus still on a couple of the things that you don't get. Some of the older business intelligence systems aren't available to you in Office 365. But as we've heard at the keynote, and as Microsoft has been hitting this drumbeat pretty hard, the cloud is the focus for their innovation. So we're seeing functions get released Office 365 first. One of the things that they announced at SharePoint conference is the introduction of 1 terabyte site collections. You used to be constrained to having 100 gig site collections. You can put a terabyte site collection in Office 365 just fine. That can be made to work on premises too, but you need to do a lot more SQL tuning, which I'll give you some guidance on later on. SharePoint environments, from an information architecture perspective, usually look like this. This is the median case for most environments. SharePoint environment begins with a farm, which is the group of single server or group of servers, including SQL, that hold SharePoint up and keep it running. Each SharePoint farm has at least 2, if not more, web applications. These are terms that we've all been using in SharePoint for a number of years, but they can be a little bit esoteric. The best thing to think about is, for a web application, is it is a top-level URL. So http://internet, being a good example of those. That is a web application. And most SharePoint farms have at least 2, one for central administration and one for the primary enterprise content environment. If you're running My Sites, you will have a My Site host, usually set up as its own web application. And you may have a multiplicity of web applications there. Each web application itself is the container for what's called a site collection. A site collection is a group, is a site or a group of sites. See, there we go. So in most environments, it typically looks like this. You will have a root level site and a couple of subsites underneath it. This comprises a site collection. A site collection will live inside of a content database. You can have multiple site collections in a content database, but you can't have multiple content databases for a site collection. A site collection could contain one and only one site inside of it. It is a database frontier. It is a security frontier. So the groups, by default, the groups and the data that live in one site collection are not exposed to other site collections that live in the same farm. And SharePoint still remains, there's a lot of data that goes in there and more applications than ever, but it's still a document repository in most enterprises. Documents live inside libraries, and inside a library you may have multiple content types. The most common content type is just called document, but you may, in a managed content environment, you may define multiple things like presentation and set up structured metadata to define what is going to go, what information you want to capture about each presentation. When was it given? What products were discussed? And you can use, you attach selected content types to selected libraries. It's not an all or nothing thing. To run SharePoint on premises, these are the launch requirements. If you're running a single server build, you need 24 gig of RAM. Microsoft's guidance for 2013 is, for most farm servers, they want a minimum of 12. This is a big bump from 2010, but it's also a codification. But those of us in the field have been telling Microsoft and telling our customers and our clients for years is that SharePoint is memory hungry. It runs on Windows 2008 R2 or 2012, and the databases that it supports, 2008 R2 and Denali, which is the 2012 release. It is not yet fully supported on 2012 R2. There are some, yeah, they were trying to get the Service Pack 1 for SharePoint released the same time as the Exchange Service Pack, the same week. And they were trying to get all of the R2 support in there. It's going to be slipstreamed in a cumulative update over the next 2 months. And there's some, and there are known workarounds to get it to work. It's really just getting the installer to recognize the system. There's no giant thing in there. Okay. For running SharePoint, you have what are called on-premises shared service applications. So this used to be a monolith, but each one of the subsystems that comprise things like search or managed metadata or user profiles is a separate web application. It lives and is connected through inside central admin, and I'll show you where this is when we get to demo. But it's worth understanding that you can take these things, and they can be defined to live at the enterprise level and be shared across multiple farms. So you may have one master search instance that covers multiple farms in your enterprise. They could cover dev, test, prod environments. There's a mix and match bit of the architecture. Just one thing to keep in mind is that you also have the ability to take these and give out administrative control to some of these applications, if you choose to end users where appropriate. And a good example of this is managed metadata services. Typically, IT does not want to be engaged every time the project office sets up a new project and wants to enter a new code. So you can delegate control of metadata or control of user profiles to HR without opening up the keys to the kingdom to the rest of the SharePoint administrative hierarchy. I imagine that for many of you, you may have or be inheriting a SharePoint environment that's already set up, but I wanted to give you just a quick overview of what's involved in the installation process and if you need to move content over there. We are not going to do it. I do a day-long session on SharePoint upgrade. There's no way I can cram that into this, but I'll give you the roadmap. When you are installing SharePoint, there are two wizards when you're running from the ISO. The first one we call the gray wizard. The gray wizard is the equivalent of a command line utility called psconfig. It runs through the process at the end of the installer of deploying the SharePoint binaries and properly registering them on every server in the farm. When you set it up, there are a couple of options if you're playing with this about, do you want to set up a standalone environment or a complete environment? And it keeps trying to default you to these standalone single server builds that put SQL Express. Do not pick those. You can't change that once it's out there. You can run a single server build on top of SQL by setting it up as a complete farm upgrade, but the complete farm options give you the option to add new servers in the future. Single server, you're permanently constrained, and you have to be migrating from it anyway. We pick during the setup what database server is going to host the environment, what is the master service account, so-called database accent account or the SharePoint farm account. That's the kind of the most important thing to blow my ears out if I walk over there again. That's the most important service account. You should not let anyone in your organization know what those passwords are. I've talked to organizations that set up one master account for SharePoint Farm and SharePoint Administration, and they tell their users, if you're ever trying to find a bit of content, just go log in as SP Farm. The password is passatword1, and you'll be able to get anything you like. And then users think that they know the password. They don't. They lock the account out, and the farm goes down. Of course, in fact, it's not a really good security practice to just hand out the admin password to everyone. So this goes, runs 10, 15 minutes. The gray wizard disappears, and you're going to be presented with the white wizard. It is more powerful, just as in the Lord of the Rings, but a little spacier. It does some things that we don't always agree with, but it does get you where you need to be. The goal of the white wizard is to set up and register automatically every shared service application that you need to support the environment. A full SharePoint build will set up about 20 shared service applications, and each with 1 to 3 databases underneath them. The wizard will set them all up for you the first time, and if you've never set up SharePoint, you should feel perfectly free to just use the wizard for that. It does some things that, from a structural perspective, aren't ideal. It puts long GUIDs into every database name. And so you have to constantly say, WCS content, long GUID, which environment is that for? And it sets up my sites to live inside the primary content database, which in most organizations, you want to keep those separate so you can keep them in separate databases and handle the growth accordingly. It's a good first place to start. If you don't use the white wizard, you have to go to PowerShell. You can't do a full farm setup without the UI. One of the things that used to be a shared service application in 2010 and is no longer is Office Web Applications. Because of the success of OWA in 2010, Microsoft moved it, restructured it, largely so that Exchange and Link could also tap into it. Office Web Applications provide that browser-based access to let me look at and edit documents directly from the browser, whether I have a version of Office installed there or not. It is not essential for SharePoint 2013 to run, but any places like Search or in Social where you have document previews, they don't work. They use OWA to light those things up. the installation process. I have a couple copies of my book on SharePoint 2010. So if you have a question, it just occurred to me, someone asked a question. I have three copies, so I'm going to save one for the end. And you asked a good question before. One of my favorite trivia questions is, where do you go in SharePoint Central Admin to set up Office Web Apps? The answer is you don't. It's a whole PowerShell interface. SharePoint's very good about prerequisite checks and automatically installing prerequisites. OWA, how many of you have set up OWA for your Exchange environments? Yeah, OWA doesn't do that for you. You have to manually make sure these are the core prerequisites that you need. It is not recommended to run it under open port 80. It's usually better to set it up properly with DNS and with certificates. But the key thing that you're going to do is with PowerShell, you're going to import the module for OWA, which registers about 8 commandlets. There's not a lot to the OWA environment. And a command like this will set up a new farm. You say, what's the internal URL? What's the external URL people are going to connect to it? And these three options say, it's OK to run on port 80. I'm going to presume all my users are licensed, so I'm going to open this up for editing. Otherwise, it's just a viewer. And the last option is about clip art. That's the OWA side. On SharePoint, just as you have with Exchange, there's a similar command. Exchange command is something in the set organization commandlet. I don't work with it all that often. But the SharePoint equivalent is SPWAPI binding. You say, where's the name of the server? And that registers the OWA farm back to SharePoint, so it knows where to go to pass that information over. Two bits of troubleshooting worth knowing. I know this is blacked out a little bit, but wherever you install OWA, that server /hosting/discovery, if you put it in type it into a browser, you should get an XML format that shows all of the kinds of documents that it knows how to handle. The other thing that sometimes gets flaky with SharePoint is the OAuth configuration doesn't get set up appropriately. So this PowerShell here, in a pinch, will get you through that. It will basically, the key thing here is allow OAuth over HTTP, especially if you're not running in encrypted mode. That you may need to do if users are reporting that nothing's coming up in their browser. The upgrade process, at a high level for moving stuff, there is no, in the box, there is no in-place upgrade for SharePoint. SharePoint installation upgrades usually begin with building a clean farm, setting up any required custom code and service applications the way we want it. Then we do a backup and restore on the SQL content databases, and we attach them in PowerShell to SharePoint itself. The process of attaching it is what upgrades it to use the 2013 schemas. When those databases come up, they're running in 2010 mode. There is a separate process by which you go back and say, this site collection I now want to run in fully 2013 compatible mode. The reason for that is got a lot to do with custom code. There are some parts of custom code that write information into what we call the 14 hive, or the SharePoint root, which is in web server extension /14, because for whatever reason that SharePoint is tied to Office and it was version 14.0 of Office. You have two separate rendering engines. There's a 2010 rendering engine and a 2013 rendering engine in this. The process of upgrading modes from one to the other is resource intensive. It's got to go through and make extensive changes to the databases, so that gives you the option of keeping it in 2010 mode essentially in perpetuity. When you're setting a SharePoint environment up, a couple of things. Please, please, please use SQL aliases. Just as I said, there's one master account. There is one master database called SharePoint Config that gets set up. It is essentially unmovable. So if you put it on a SQL server and want to move it somewhere else later, you're basically out of luck. There's some hacks that can be done with it, but within Microsoft support guidance, you're basically migrating to a new farm. So if you use SQL aliases, how many of you know what SQL aliases are? Show of hands, okay. So the idea of a SQL alias is it's a way that you can just set a placeholder name, same as you would do for an SMTP alias. So you wouldn't necessarily want the machine name to be your SMTP target for something. You want to have a DNS alias so that if you change the servers under that support SMTP in your environment, everything that was pointing to mailhost.contoso.com is still going to point to the right place. We're just updating the pointer. SQL aliasing is the same thing. On the machine, there's a place inside ODBC setup where you can say, I just want to call this SPSQL. And that way, if you ever need to move to a different database server down the road, all you have to do is update the aliases to point to the new physical server. It's also worth noting SharePoint 2013, by default, sets things up running in claims mode. The end user experience is essentially the same. The default claims provider in SharePoint 2013 is a claim against a Windows Active Directory source, so you can specify other things for forms-based authentication and other custom identity providers. The place that this really can get screwy on you is if you have custom code that runs in your environment that wasn't coded to work with claims. So there is a way to set 2013 up to run in classic NT-auth mode, but you have to use PowerShell to do it with a new SP web application commandlet. If you were looking at Office 365, and I know many of you are, one of the things you need to be prepared for is how do you migrate from an on-premises installation of SharePoint to Office 365? There's really two things to consider, the content and the security. As of today, there is no Microsoft-supplied tool to let you onboard your on-premises content and take it up to the cloud. There's a ton of third parties out there. I used to work for one of them that sell migration utilities for the content. Otherwise, you're setting up a new environment and manually transferring stuff up there. The other thing is security. And with one last note, this is my personal opinion, that's not going to continue. Microsoft has to provide some way to onboard content to Office 365. There are tools, obviously, for moving your Exchange mailboxes from on-premises to Office 365. And we could debate whether what Microsoft supplies is perfect or not, but there is a way to do it, and if you don't like Microsoft's way, then you can go into the aftermarket and find something else. They have to do something on the content side. The preferred way that Microsoft would recommend that you set up security migration is to use Windows Azure Active Directory Connector, otherwise known by its former name, DirSync. DirSync is not a migration utility, per se. What Wadic does, I've got to start using the right name. The idea is you're going to have Active Directory on premises, and somewhere you're going to have a machine that's running Wadic that compares Active Directory on premises and passes those credentials over to synchronize them to the Office 365 Active Directory, and it will synchronize the passwords. There are two identities still, but users can use the same username format and the same password between both environments. So based on how often you set it to run, and the default is 4 hours, that covers most scenarios. It's not true migration. There are also ways that you can just set up new accounts for people, but most of the time, people don't want to go out and learn all new passwords. So there are some tools for getting your security credentials up there. Okay. That's also not Boston, Massachusetts. My wife's from California, so I took that picture. So we can go deep into all kinds of tuning and optimization. This is the most common service request that you're going to get to support a SharePoint environment on-premises or in Office 365. And it's usually not custom code. It's something like this. I want a new site, and I want to have some specialized security. I may want to add a custom field there. And of course, can you do this now? So I want to introduce just a couple of the templates that are going to be your best friend in how you respond to this most common service request. The worker bee of SharePoint is the team site. We'll take a look at each of these shortly. There's also a template that comes inside of the box called a project site, which is a variation of the team site. Team site has all but, well, you'll see, the team site has a lot in it. The project site is attuned to having tasks and timelines and documents that go along with them. They're a good starting place. You can add more things to it. A site mailbox, based on the use case, might be an appropriate scenario, based on where the users are and how they want to contribute content. Just as public folders are going away, Microsoft is trying to move away from the idea of mail-enabled document libraries. And so kind of between public folders and mail-enabled document libraries, we have site mailboxes, which provide a way to get a user experience that lives inside of the browser for all of that content rather than that can be connected to through Outlook. I know there have been plenty of sessions in site mailboxes, but it's one of your options here. A Yammer group is also a possible way to handle that based on where the users live and what kind of interactions they want. There's also a template called a community site, which we'll look at. And of course, my favorite, no, you can't have a site, which sometimes is the right answer because what they're asking for is a duplicate of something that's already out there. They don't really understand why they need it. SharePoint is notorious for content sprawl and duplicate content. And if you don't have good governance and rules around when is what SharePoint is appropriate for, you're going to wind up with with basically a mess. So the team site, which we'll be looking at in demo, is the worker bee. It provides a shared OneNote notebook, document libraries, calendars. It's essentially there so you can start getting a team working on whatever purpose is out there possibly. Then there's the project site, which is a variation on it, but it puts up in center a task list. So how many of you run Project Server? Excellent. I used to do a ton with Project Server. It is a really complicated beast. It is great for sophisticated organizations. Most of your users aren't going to be that sophisticated. They have a project. They're going to have a dozen people working on it. There's two dozen things to do. They're not going to be setting up a Microsoft project file. They're not going to be dealing with resource balancing and leveling issues. They just want a place where people can go and see what's on track and what's not. That's the goal of the project site. Site mailboxes, again, give you the ability to, using email, the most ubiquitous collaboration technology has been, probably always will be, to do essentially the same things. So this actually is a snippet from one of the SharePoint Saturdays that I run back east. We were using this to collect all the speaker documentation since lots of people were getting stuff from lots of different places. And it was one place to make sure that we're bringing that content into SharePoint. One of the knocks, to be fair, on the site mailbox, in my opinion, is somewhat incomplete, is that you get to it through SharePoint. The document content isn't as accessible as a lot of SharePoint admins would like, because we like to see documents that live in libraries, because then I can attach information policies to it. I know how to deal with libraries. I can back stuff up in libraries. They're not as easily addressable. The community site will handle that for most folks. Yammer groups, I should get my soda. Yammer, it's the social call, is very much the direction Microsoft is heading in. Site mailboxes were designed and architected in many cases for an on-premises implementation. And they made it, as some of you know, it's a lot more difficult to set up. The advantage of a Yammer group is click, click, there you have it. There's some debates about where does their content. They haven't fully integrated content management from Yammer with the OneDrive SharePoint way of doing things, but a Yammer group is also an appropriate way of handling that. So the community site is kind of a hybrid of all of those. So it provides a way that if people have questions and need to post documents, they can post them to a community site. There's some badgification. You can see who the top contributors are, what discussions are going on. Some people respond well to gamification, but it's essentially there for people to pose questions and have discussions in a structured manner through the web browser. And it has the advantage of if you attach information to something in a community site, it lives in a document library. So a little bit more easily managed from formal enterprise content management rules with metadata and content types. And there's a couple of others that are out there. There's document centers and record centers. Document centers are designed for a large pool of 500,000 documents. Record centers are if you have closely managed record declarations and you want to ship them to a central site. That's the role of the record center. Blank site, there is a site template that has nothing in it. You can go and add custom libraries and lists to it. Wikis, blogs, and BI also may be an appropriate starting place. In my opinion, these are the most common site types you're going to be looking at, where you need to go to get it. The vast majority of these are installed, and I'll show you this shortly, inside of site contents. Some of them, obviously, Yammer is not available on-premises. Yammer is a cloud-only service. And some of them, some of the on-premises tooling, it's debatable why you would use them in an Office 365 environment. In particular with the Record Center, usually Record Centers are close, you know, there's close compliance. We want it someplace on our system that we control. I'm not sure, although they're easy to set up, about the relevance of site mailboxes in the cloud, since if you're going to be running a cloud-hosted service, Microsoft is going to be putting more investments around Yammer than in the site mailbox over time. But these may be some of the ways that you approach that. I think I am at this for troubleshooting. Actually, I'm going to set something up here in the meantime. I want to do this. We can come back to it. So here we are in an Office 365 environment. And I mentioned before some of the things that you may be asked to set up are sites and then applications inside of those sites. So inside site contents is where I would come. And inside of this Hurricane Systems site collection, I'm going to set up a subsite, working on it, the official message of SharePoint. This is my O365 tenant. It's being awfully fussy. I'm going to let that run, and I'll come back to it. So this is truly, not just working on it, but this is truly the default user welcome screen for SharePoint, most SharePoint environments. The user gets a message that says something went wrong, error, and they get something called a correlation ID. And that's something most users have no idea what to do. So I want to demystify that somewhat and show you how you can use this to get more information about these problems if someone sends you a screenshot. So Microsoft has some tooling that's out there to help sort these things out. There's a health checker, there are web analytics engines to look at usage and resources, but by far, the most important tool you have is something that's called the developer dashboard. The developer dashboard relies upon Microsoft's logging architecture. So the core architecture from 2010 to 2013 did not go through significant revisions. So one of the things that they've been doing for a while is based on this, the idea that a database, which by default is called WSS logging, and we'll look at it, can be set up to provide a central access point for all the rest of the information. SharePoint can go out and gather metrics, unified logging service logs from SharePoint, Windows event logs, feature code, anything into one centralized logging database. This is an open schema, and you're totally fine going into it, running queries, and playing with it. Microsoft did this to basically open up that whole process. One of the things, one of the interfaces into it is called the developer dashboard, which we'll look at in demo. But this is the developer dashboard in 2013. Developer dashboard was built for developers. But in my opinion, it is one of the most important tools that an IT pro can have as well. So I'm going to guess, how many of you have ever been on a help desk or had to manage a help desk? So this is a typical request. The SharePoint site is slow. What do you say, what does your help to say to people if they say the SharePoint site is slow? Reboot, clear your cache, don't bother me again, hope it doesn't happen. The advantage of developer dashboard is it starts to point us in the right directions. It provides a way for us to look at what's going on. It gives us these correlation IDs, which we'll look at shortly. And it tells us what's happening from a time perspective on each section of the page. Developer dashboard is set up using PowerShell, which I'll show you here shortly. Once you turn, it is not on by default, but once you turn it on, it provides the ability to run this window to track, for example, how long is SQL taking? It used to be help desk could only tell you to reboot your machine since it's really complicated. You've got a very large server farm. what I am able to use this for in my consulting is if I'm looking at this information and I see it's taking 4 seconds to load the page, I know that something's wrong. And if I look and see that my SQL queries are running long, I have a SQL issue. If I look at the scopes and or the SP requests, I may have a code issue. I could be out of memory on an IIS server. Or if I go and I see that this page is actually, from a server perspective, if I saw that this is running at 100 milliseconds, the server is doing everything just fine, but I may have a network issue. There could be a latency issue if users are perceiving slowness. So this provides a good place to start triaging where to look to troubleshoot issues.
Can I do this in 365?
Not directly, not yet. So when we look at the correlation IDs in the logging database, Microsoft has not yet, we were talking about this with them last year, they haven't yet opened up the correlation ID database to multiple tenants. So you have to open a service request, give them the correlation ID, and they'll give it back. They're working on it. I know that they're working. There was a discussion in one of the online communities that parts of the code in the API are there right now. People who are doing reflection have figured out there's a way you actually can pass a correlation ID in and get the error message on some tenants, but not on all. So it's not fully there yet. It is coming. So WSS logging, as I mentioned, is the master database that all this information comes from. All of those logging systems in a small environment, this is a little bit of overkill. But if you have a large multi-server farm and a user's having an InfoPath issue or they're having an issue with just uploading a document, there's no easy way to know if you have 4 web front end servers and 4 app servers, which particular server in your farm is going to have the right error logs in it. So you could go to all 8 servers and look all that stuff up, but the logging databases here that give you the ability to go look at that. By default, since these logging databases can get very large, most of the data gathering is turned off. Inside of the timer service, which we'll look at shortly, there are 200 or 300 by default jobs that run on a scheduled basis to do SharePoint things. The two that are disabled, diagnostic data provider trace log and event log, once they're turned on, will create inside of the SQL database the views for NT event log and ULS trace log. And then those jobs by default every 10 minutes are going to go out, scour all the servers and bring back anything in the NT event logs or anything in the unified logging service logs. How many of you are not SQL DBAs? Great. Every day is a good day to be nice to a SQL DBA that's out there. So if you're not familiar with how to get information out of a database, this is the core command that you're using, something that says select star from name the database where correlation ID is whatever you've seen. There's something you're looking for, and you can't do this. Your DBA should be able to do this for you fairly quickly. I've done sessions before where people start building out business intelligence. I've got a couple of SQL reports that can be used for this. But in 2013, you can get at all that ULS log information directly from the developer dashboard anyway, so having to probe into the database usually isn't that important. So I mentioned the timer service. Every automatic process that has to run according to a schedule, workflows, indexes, and the like, all run from the timer service. The timer service itself, in 2010, frequently needed to be manually reset. In 2013, it's by design, it will refresh itself at least weekly. Because if the timer service is responsible for firing off all these scheduled jobs, and if something goes wrong with it, obviously, none of your scheduled jobs that are out there are going to run. It also can be addressed through PowerShell. So the snippet that I put here is one from an upgrade demo. If you are flipping sites from 2010 to 2013 mode, that's one of those long-running processes that's run from the timer service. And if there's any timer service jobs that should be run, we've got a little bit of PowerShell. What this command will do is it will start the timer service in any of those pending jobs, for example. You also can do it directly from the UI. I think I'm close to moving to demo. Backup and recovery. Microsoft has improved some of the tooling for backup and recovery. In many cases, if you're looking for true granular leaf level recovery, that's provided by third-party tools. Microsoft provides a way to back up essentially a whole content database and do a whole content database recovery from it in the event of a catastrophe, or to reach out and look at smaller pieces of SharePoint, pull them out, put them somewhere else, and then inject them back to where they need to go using PowerShell. You can do a smaller backup through the UI of a piece of a site collection, of a list or a library, to generate a file that can then be maintained and then manually restored through PowerShell. And you can also reach out to, it used to be that to work with SharePoint content for recovery, you had to have a recovery farm. In 2010 and 2013, all I need is the database. It doesn't need to be connected to SharePoint anywhere. I just need access to the database, and I'll show you this. I can browse its content, pull out a selective subset, and then restore it where it needs to go using the PowerShell command import spweb. You're also going to be usually doing SQL backups, and SharePoint's in-the-box backup utility needs some care because left to itself, it will run ad infinitum and fill up the disks where it's dumping. Typically, I like to see a backup that runs through PowerShell. This command, and we'll be looking at PowerShell shortly, is the essential. There's a way to do this using the older command line utilities called STSADM, but this is the core PowerShell you use to back up a farm. I'm doing a little bit of trickery with the files and directories, so the goal of this is to maintain 2 days of backups. Because for anything older, you're going to be going to tape, you're going to be going to SQL, presumably that's off-site. This is to give a SharePoint admin a fighting chance if someone says, I just deleted something, I know it was in last night's backup, you have a place to go get it because you've executed this command, backup SP farm, directory where it goes, full backup. And the rest of this, just make sure wherever I'm going, I'm only keeping 2 days. There's no deduplication in the backup environment, so if you just run this command every day on a 1 terabyte farm, after a year, you'll have 365 terabytes of backups. So not to be run without some grooming, and that's what I'm doing in this. I'm going to skip through for PowerShell, get to the demo. You'll have that if you download the deck. Just a couple things I want to introduce. We'll be walking through this right now. One of the key things that you may want to do is be able to look at default file sizes. And SharePoint, PowerShell gives us the ability to make settings across a range of sites at the same time. So if I want to know across multiple web applications what's the maximum file size, I'm using this command to get a handle to the web application and the pipe saying, which takes the output of this and dumps it to the select statement. Select statement says, for all of the web applications, just show me URL and maximum file size. And then we pipe it again to format table with the auto size command to give us that output right there. Then you can set it. This command would set it across the board to 250, I won't say 250 gigs, 250 megabytes, which is the default. The maximum file size you can support in SharePoint is 2 gig. And that's how I would set it to 2 gig. Web application, where I'm putting it, max file size, and update. So let's take the next slide in reverse order and take a look at PowerShell. With me 1 second. Cloud-based demos, please be nice. I think something went to sleep. Or someone took the network down. I think the conference Wi-Fi is down. Both networks, it's not connecting. I'll come back to this. Sorry?
I guess they are shutting down.
Yeah, it's because they are. So, see if I can get this up later. So let's just push on, and if the network resumes, I'll look at it over here. So some other things to bear in mind when you're looking at some of Microsoft's end user tooling, OneDrive and OneDrive for Business. Yes?
Just a quick question before you go on.
Yeah.
About backup. Yeah, off the top of your head, do you know how long Office 365 holds SharePoint sites files for?
I want to say 60 days, but I'm not sure.
Okay. And do you know if you can do any sort of granular recovery from those?
You, in theory, can.
Okay. I know the reporting.
A lot of people buy utilities just to give them control of those sorts of things. So if you've deployed Service Pack 1 or anything with Microsoft, you'll now see that Service Pack 1 means I have this link that's called OneDrive. A fair bit of user confusion about the names OneDrive or its predecessor SkyDrive and how they relate to SharePoint. OneDrive is a consumer service. It lives in the cloud. OneDrive for Business is SharePoint's personal cloud. And so if you follow a OneDrive link to SharePoint on-premises, by default, it will take you to personal storage that lives on your on-premises SharePoint farm. If you're in Office 365, that personal storage lives in Office 365. A number of financial organizations I've consulted with get confused on this because they say, we have a rule that none of our data can go to the cloud, so I don't want to use something called SkyDrive or OneDrive because it's going to go to the cloud. It doesn't if you're on-premises. Microsoft did introduce, with Service Pack 1, the option to have essentially an on switch inside of the environment where I can selectively say, I want all that end-user file storage, my site stuff, to live in OneDrive for Business. But just the advantage of OneDrive for Business is that that personal storage, there's multiple clients available for Android, for any of the iOS-based applications, as well as Windows intrinsically, in addition with the browser. And you will see the name SkyDrive show up in a variety of locations. Inside of OneDrive for Business, SkyDrive Pro, anywhere actually you have document content in SharePoint, there's been a big change in how permissions get managed because Microsoft has introduced something in the 2013 environment called Share. If I looked at a SharePoint 2010 environment or earlier, and I wanted to know what permissions were, even though I've had granular permissions available to me for 7 years, most SharePoint libraries, every document has exactly the same permissions. In the Exchange world, you know, most users only have one mailbox. You may delegate permission, but you don't have a lot of granular permissions that come up. Microsoft finally admitted that in the word SharePoint, the word share should mean something. So in 2013, they added this button, and a user can selectively share a document and decide who they want to share it to. So no two documents, if this is enabled, will necessarily have the same permissions in the same library. This isn't a problem. This kind of most user behavior, if they want a document to be moved where someone else can view it, they copy it. So you lead to duplication. So the idea now is I can have something in a personal store or an enterprise store, and the end user can say, I now want to share it with these two or three people and set permissions. If the user has full control over the document, they get to do that. If they don't have full control of the document, it triggers a workflow and you need administrative approval for it. You have the option inside of SharePoint Online and SharePoint on-premises to enable what are called access requests. When I'm looking inside the permission section for my site, inside of site settings, I can configure those access requests right there, for access request settings, and basically it's asking me the email address to which access requests should go. And then the admin can, from inside of that email or by going to a console, accept or deny that. So if a user gets a URL to something they're not allowed to see, the default behavior is they don't get it. If access requests are enabled, they get a screen that says, explain why you want access to this, and we'll pass the request along. Access requests are also how we govern the share behaviors. So you get the why do you need access to this site, or if I want to share a document and I don't have full control, that message will go to the site owners or wherever I've set the access requests, and they have to decide whether that moves forward. They receive an email, and they can either go directly into the email. Here's one that claims that my dog, Stan, wants to share this file with my son. I'm not quite sure how my dog got to be so good with SharePoint, but you get an email there for accept or decline this request. And inside of site settings, access requests and invitation, you can also see all pending requests, any notes that are attached to it, and right from there, choose whether to accept or deny those requests. All of this is essential, essentially requires that SMTP be configured. And I'm a little hesitant to use this slide because you all know more about Exchange than I do. In my opinion, it's not good configuration to have SharePoint dump off all of its outbound SMTP requests directly to an Exchange server, whatever you're running. It's usually better to have one set up SMTP relay host that's only allowed to relay from SharePoint to your Exchange farm. Because the alternative is, as you're adding servers, as servers go up and go down over time, you may wind up with a promiscuous mode where your Exchange server is set up to receive, will accept inbound SMTP traffic from anyone on the internal network or anyone at all. Running that kind of open relay, in my opinion, is just terrible. I've worked in some very closely governed environments where only specific machines are allowed to send SMTP to my Exchange farm. So to give a little bit more control and flexibility, you have to set this up. Why do I need to set this up? Because I can't turn on access requests until SharePoint knows where do I send emails if I have to send emails. That's configured inside of SharePoint Central Administration in outgoing email settings. On Office 365, you don't have to worry about that. Office 365 implementations are specifically set up with outbound email enabled. But in my opinion, it's usually easier to set up SPSMTP as a role on a server that the SharePoint environment controls. If you're doing both, if you're responsible for both environments, and you will, every time you add a SharePoint server, register it properly to SMTP, this step may not be necessary. It has a lot to do with, do you have to give blood to get the SMTP relay list opened up or not? 2 bits of PowerShell, which I may or may not be able to show you. It's back up. Great. So this is going to wind up just perfect. The first one is about, they're very similar. If I want to see, because I may have lots of email, people have set this up over time, maybe I want to go back and apply governance to this and say, show me the sites that don't have access requests on or where they're sending their emails. This will dump this all to the command line. This allows me to say, I want you to, for any site that's got custom access requests, set it to something specific. So let's see, are we back up and running? Please, 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 demo gods, be nice. Not feel good. Are you on Mac 2014 or the 5 gig?
I'm on the 5G.
Yeah, I'm just, it's just circling here.
Which one are you trying to connect to?
5G. I was on the non-5G.
Yeah, 5G's only got 3 bars.
It's giving me 5 bars, but it's giving me, connecting is taking longer than usual. We're running short on time, so if I can pull a demo up before the end, that'll be great. Otherwise, I want to make sure we cover this material. Some things about optimizing your environment. SharePoint requires patching. The SharePoint patch process isn't obvious, and I've had people assume that since they've run Windows Update, their SharePoint environment is patched. Windows Update only will grab a service pack. It will not grab a cumulative update. And it will only cover the first part of this. So there is an installer which will basically unpack the files and put them out there for SharePoint. But you need to, after I've set that up, either run the gray wizard, which is formerly called the SharePoint Products Technologies Wizard, or the command line equivalent psconfig on each server in my farm, which will properly register that service pack and deploy it to all the servers that are in the farm. Usually we start with central administration servers, move out to app servers, and then finally the web front end servers. In 2013, there's more flexibility. You don't necessarily have to take the whole farm down as long as you're not patching, trying to catch up with 3 years of patches at once. There's a lot more tolerance for allowing slightly different patch levels to coexist during the upgrade, during the update process. It's very quirky. SharePoint is very finicky about cumulative updates every 2 months, service packs every 6 to 18. Service pack 1 came out last month. There's always some quirks. Whoa, sorry. I am wide awake. There's definitely been some quirks with, like, the June 2013 CU for 2010, which had some advanced bits that weren't in SP2 or were fixed in downstream in the builds. In the 2013 environment, it's worth noting, Microsoft had a code branching thing that happened with the RTM version. You can't patch the RTM version of SharePoint. You can patch it with Service Pack 1, but you can't patch it with a cumulative update, because the official baseline for cumulative updates was the March 2013 public update. So if you're ever getting, I can't find the required version of this in your environment, it's because you're not running the March update. You need the March update first, or Service Pack 1 will fix that. I'm finicky about keeping track of all the internal build numbers for these sorts of things. I do it on my personal blog at chrismcnulty.net/blog. If you go to version build upgrades, it's very good at letting you move from looking inside of SharePoint Central Admin, where it'll tell you this farm is running 15.0.1000.5295. I don't remember what that is either, but to cross-reference it and go back and say, oh, I'm running the June update, or I'm running Service Pack 1. Service Pack 1 introduced functionally, these are the two things that you may want to look at. Selective use of hybrid workloads for Yammer. Yammer still is somewhat autonomous, but it provides a way that you can add a Yammer link to the page Chrome at the top of the page to shell out to a new Yammer window. And Yammer is a little more tightly integrated than it was a year ago. It's obviously a work in progress. And also the ability to selectively say, I don't want OneDrive, even though I'm on premises, I want to have my OneDrive for business in the cloud so my end users can connect to their personal files on their tablet, on their smartphone, from wherever they are in the world, and we'll keep the enterprise content on premises. It supports that, along with a change to the API to introduce for JSON coders a light mode. Formerly, when you were querying for a list of objects through JSON, it would return full metadata and be slow. You now have the ability to ask to set verbosity levels on the returned metadata, none, selective, or full. Okay, SQL performance tuning. I said before, SQL is intrinsic to making your SharePoint environment run properly. Quick primer, for those of you who haven't looked at the specific RAID levels in a while, there's basically, for all intents and purposes, and storage engineers will debate this, but that there are more, but there's really three levels of building in redundancy using RAID technology. RAID 1 is using mirroring. We have a document, and when we write it, this, if these were each 100 gig, they're mirroring. So two 100 gig disks add up to being 100 gig of mirrored content. It's very expensive, but it's high performance. RAID 5 is using parity. So the idea is when I write to that environment, it stripes the data across multiple disks and adds a checksum. So if anything ever doesn't line up, it knows that it's got a bad disk. And in most environments, as I add multiple, and storage implementations can differ, but the stripes and checksums are uniformly distributed so that the loss of any single disk doesn't comprise the array, in theory. And finally, RAID 10, RAID 1 plus 0, 0 plus 1, stripes of mirrors, mirrors of stripes. Data is simultaneously striped across a mirrored set or mirrored across stripe sets. The catch with, let me just back up to this, because I'm doing a checksum, there's a calculation that happens on every save. So RAID 5 can be a little slower than RAID 10, but it's fairly efficient. We want to get the best performance of our SQL environment. So in my experience, if you have the ability to have multiple storage groups, the goal is we want as many things handling the workload as possible. We want RAID 1 on our boot disks. RAID 5 is a fair compromise for most SharePoint data environments in that SharePoint tends to be more read-intensive than write-intensive in most scenarios. RAID 10 is where we want to have log disks, temp files, and the like, and as much as possible. If we can have different sets of spindles handling all those workloads, that's great. We're trying to drive to the maximum number of input-output operations per second. So SharePoint is increasingly, in the environment, more content than ever, more users than ever, and more ways. The new Microsoft that's opening up to Android and to iOS makes it more likely that more people are going to be adding content into a SharePoint environment than ever before. Microsoft's technique for managing this kind of growth is twofold. There's a technology called RBS, which allows me to selectively move those files outside of a SQL database where they can be really inefficient at the large scale and put them in something else, a file share, for example, or a bit of SAN storage. About 3 years ago, Microsoft, at the time of Service Pack 1, refined their guidance. They didn't make any technical changes, but they refined their guidance. What they said is, up to 200 gigs of information in a content database, no limits. Between 200 gigs and 4 terabytes, we really want to see that you can generate 2 input-output operations per second. Most direct-attached arrays are going to be able to provide hundreds of IOPS per second, so you can definitely go well in excess of 200 gigs. And some other rules about if I'm doing a document archive scenario, you can theoretically have infinite storage there because those are so sparsely used and usually there's no item level security or workflows running in those environments. In 2013, Microsoft introduced the poorly named shredded storage. Because in essence, if you have a 100 meg file, you save it to SharePoint, it saves 100 meg. Originally, if I'm not using shredded storage, if I have it essentially disabled, or RBS, and I make an edit to that document with versioning, I'm not chewing up 200 megs of storage. If I'm using RBS, I'm moving all of that content out to something else on the SAN. So SQL, there's still some metadata that sits there, and pointers that go out to the SAN storage, but I've kept SQL relatively clean. However, every version is going to continue to grow up. In 2013, Microsoft introduced shredded storage, which is much better at being able to only save the parts of a file that change. So if I edited 20% of my 100 meg file with shredded storage only, it's going to consume about 120 meg. You would never have a shred that's 20 megs, by the way, but it's just it's really impossible to do that. And if I turn RBS on, I can still keep everything very small here and optimize the performance. In conjunction with Dell, there's been a lot of research that's been done into best practices around this. And what we've seen is the default setting for this is 64K for shreds. And that line is all the way up here. In testing, we find that the best performance for a lot of files is usually somewhere between a meg or 1250. And comparing RBS versus SQL, RBS can be slower, certainly is slower on small files, but for larger files, what we're finding is it's much faster at reads because there's fewer things that have to be reassembled through a SQL stack. So our best practices are, in most cases, you're going to be setting this parameter called file write chunk size to 1024 to 1250K. I have a link in the references slide to get to all the research behind this. Shredded storage is configured through PowerShell. RBS is usually a third-party tool, so you'd be looking to Metalogix, AvePoint, Dell, or whoever your third-party provider would be for how they implement that, but to set a rule saying anything bigger than a meg, I'd want to move those files out. And here's the PowerShell for that. We'll have it. I've got 5 minutes to go. and 18 slides. Again, SQL performance tuning, three things to keep in mind. You can compress backups, and you should. Otherwise, the sparse data will be kept sparse and chew up a lot more disk space. I mentioned that SQL performance is usually end users' perceived biggest problem with it. It's the backup process that leads to the most downtime, because people will have unfettered backups, they'll fill up hard disks, and essentially you'll never be able to move forward. SQL also likes to run everything in fully logged mode, and poor maintenance and backup of the transaction logs is another place that people chew up disk and fill up drives. If you're going to back up the transaction logs for SQL, great. If you're not going to do it, in most environments, you can set that to simple mode. And you can make that change effectively going forward by resetting the SQL ModelDB to use simple modes. The future content databases created for model will inherit that setting. I'm going to skip forward. And the last service to be aware of is something called distributed cache, which is new in 2013. It is poorly understood. The default behavior is distributed cache turns itself on every SharePoint server, and you don't want that. Distributed cache does not do well if it's running on a place that's running Excel services, that's running search, or business intelligence. It either should be on a dedicated server, or it should only be left enabled on the BI servers. Not the BI servers, on the web front end servers. It also, this is real important, any servers that are running distributed cache service need to have a fixed memory allocation. If you are running a server that is using variably subscribed virtual memory, and it could be anywhere from 16 to 24 gig based on what's available, that's great for IIS performance. It is terrible for distributed cache. Distributed cache has the idea of, I'm going to pre-assemble things that are expensive to query in a shared cache that all the SharePoint environments can participate in, so they don't have to keep regenerating the same queries over and over and over again. Distributed cache is like, remember the Saturday Night Live bit about do not taunt Happy Funball? DC is Happy Funball for SharePoint, because if you mess around with the setting, if you play with it with the Windows App Fabric or any of the things you're not supposed to do, Microsoft has in bold on TechNet, you will corrupt your farm and have to rebuild from scratch. Do not do these things. It will mess you up if you play with it for the wrong reasons. There's some guidance that can be given about how much distributed cache you need based on the number of users that are out there. In larger environments of 10,000 users or more, you're going to have some dedicated servers for distributed cache. Otherwise, running it on the web front-end servers is probably the way to go. Okay, so some common support questions that we've seen. Here's the first one. Users receive cannot connect to configuration database web page. It's all they get. Do we know why that's happened?
They haven't rebooted?
Nope. Well, usually it's because the SharePoint farm account's been locked out. Someone thinks they know the password and they didn't get it right. Here's my other one. No one can upload anything, but the site's up. You can look at all of the pages that are out there. Usually that means the database disk volume is full. Or if you're in a highly subscribed virtual environment, maybe the virtual hosts are full. This is my other favorite. Like, I think I should see this document, but I can't see it. Or someone else can't see a document that I can see. Sometimes it's because the security is not what people think it is. Sometimes because the document's been moved by an automatic process. And sometimes it's because required metadata on the document isn't there. So the default behavior, if there's a mandatory field and a user saves something without filling out the mandatory field, the document stays checked out to them. If you see users are getting a lot of complaints about, I always have to keep putting my Windows credentials in, there's usually a change that can be made to IE to tell it to use automatic login with the current username, or move the site to trusted sites. And that can be done through a group policy object. Custom workflows, again, usually it means the timer service didn't start. Todd Clint, who's the SharePoint MVP, has made the joke he's going to write a program called fixsharepoint.exe. All that it does is reset the timer service and reset IIS. That fixes most of your problems. If people say that they're not seeing stuff in search, that's usually an indicator that the search crawls are hung. And you can check the crawl logs through central administration. If they're not running, restart them. If they are running, you may have to reset the index and run a full crawl. The official answer, if you take a SharePoint certification exam with Microsoft, to this one, I need a file back that I deleted. What the help is supposed to tell the user is go to the recycle bin. Otherwise, there's going to be backup and restore techniques based on if you're using SQL backup to go mount that environment and take it up. Oh, and this last one, real important for on-premises. Microsoft has fixed this in the service, but on-premises in 2013, if users are trying to use their MySite, the default template for that quota is 100 meg for their personal sites. Microsoft will give you 2 gig by design in Office 365 now. You can change that at a quota template for on-premises as well. 100 meg users will fill it up, and as soon as they fill it up, they're not able to work with this environment anymore. That is just about all the time that we have. So, getting back to, again, despite all of the engineering that goes on, this is the work bread. This is the workhorse that you're going to be asked to do the most. Set up sites for people. And the way that you address that is usually directly through the UI. So congratulations. You've been introduced to SharePoint Admin and all this. Picture of my kids to remind me that it's time for me to go back to Massachusetts tomorrow morning. And so I have a little bit of time for Q&A. Just a couple of references. My blog is listed there. Some of the testing that Microsoft has done on RBS that I referenced quickly is available there. Two very strong resources, the last one in particular, SharePoint Elhorn. My good friend Jason Himmelstein, who actually is originally from Austin, though he lives in New Hampshire now. He is the SharePoint Longhorn, and he's one of my favorite sources for this stuff. This is not ARC 404, ARC 204. You can get a hold of me through my email address, through my blog, or at cmcnulty2000, or any one of these fine events coming up across the SharePoint world. So that said, I know we are 2 minutes over. It is the end of MEC. Thank you so much for coming. I will stick around for some questions.